When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Special edition of the Cosmic Salon. I have my friend Alan Sisko out there, and people in the Cosmic Salon universe know Alan well. He's oftentimes been in our speakeasy private chats. We've had him on the marquee. We love Alan Sisko. Alan has recently gone through a really dramatic event, and I thought this chat that we're going to have today could be helpful to people out there that may be experiencing something similar, have experienced something similar, or are just looking at the idea of how do we process the idea of our mortality. Alan is a Sifu in the Gong Fu tradition. That's an honorable position. They're not just freely given out. And I'll let Alan give a little bit of a bio, but I think most people that find this conversation will already be familiar with Alan. And one of the things that I wanted to do with this chat was get to the nitty-gritty. And the reason why I even started with Alan being a Sifu, he's super strong. He's a strong personality. But as he was going through this process, he was being very gritty and talking about the fears that have come along the journey and being honest. And that is the messaging that a lot of us need to hear, because I think people are so, in our culture, wrapped up with not looking at hard emotions, not looking at the bare grittiness of information that processes through our auric field, through the ether around us, through our emotional bodies, all of this information. And there seems to be a focus on turning your head from it and just allowing other people to take care of it instead of getting into a mental space with it and doing a dance with yourself. And that's why I felt like really just talking about this openly would be fruitful for other people. So I will wait no longer, and I will bring in my friend Alan Sisko. Alan, how are you doing?
The past 2 days have been really bad in my recovery, so got that I'm dealing with. But the surgery site looks very, very nice. I'm only going to have a minimal scar right there. But other than that, just getting along and relaxing a couple more days till I go back to work again.
Let's rewind for everyone, let's kind of go back to the beginning of what happened, Alan, because this is a very serious situation. You had congestive heart failure. So how did this start creeping up? What were the warning signs? What ultimately got you out and seeking help and then finding out, of course, what you found out?
Well, heart disease runs in my family, so it's always been in the forefront of my mind thinking about, am I doing enough cardio? Am I eating well enough? But because of that, there's a certain type of sensitivity you get when you have heart problems, to where you can wake up one day and you can feel like something's not right. And you can just tell you need to see a doctor as soon as you can. And this is the second time I've actually had congestive heart failure. So I'm very familiar with this already once before, which was a much, much worse case than I had this time. I actually almost died that time. But I went in for some testing just to make sure because of some of the symptoms I was having. And the doctor's like, yeah, your infraction rate is, you know, half what it's supposed to be. It's very low. So your heart's not pumping your blood, which is why you feel lightheaded and weak and get tired easy, and your heart beats really hard when you're trying to work out. And he was just worried with my past heart disease history that it was going to maybe do me in. So he decided to have the ICD unit do the surgery to put that in, which is a pacemaker and a defibrillator, and it's got like a Wi-Fi signal to where it can be processed through various devices to read it to see how it's functioning.
That's intense.
That was a little more than I guess you asked for the question. Sorry about that.
No. I want all the details. So let's look at the edema aspect. Were you showing edema in, I know that you can't see it around the heart, but you can feel it, I hear, but also it can show up in the ankles or down the leg. Did you have any of those symptoms going?
This time I didn't. Seemingly right now, I don't know why, but I'm not retaining liquid like sometimes that happens with CFS. I have the other symptoms that go along with it. But of course, I could just recognize the symptoms and how I felt with the way the heart was functioning, especially when I was laying down. It feels like you're drowning, kind of. And so he figured out what was going on, but I also kind of knew ahead of time, almost expecting it, you know, expecting the worst because of what I've had before.
And were you having any kind of metaphysical inclinations, say like dreams or deeper intuition or something like that coming to as well? It sounds like you did. Your intuition was on it, but I'm looking for like symbols in the outer world or something in the dreams, etc.
I wish I could say there was some dawning of knowledge that came to me in a dream or a vision, but really it was just basic medical detective work that kind of brought it to light. Though I guess you could say in a metaphysical way, I was kind of affected because it was affecting my ability to do energy work. So I had to focus on the chest and the heart more and relinquishing a lot of negative emotions that might be solidified in the heart and chest area, which is not anything amazing because of my past history, what I've gone through. It's no wonder my heart was damaged at an early age, the heart or the heart chakra, I guess you could say, as well. So it's almost like a precursor to you're going to have problems later on, even if you don't know it. But there was no real, just aside from just feeling the subtle body underneath not functioning like it's supposed to with the physical body.
Yes. And so then when you got your appointment to have surgery, you ended up with a head cold and some of this. And this is dangerous territory. So give us some of what was going on with that and how that was affecting your emotional body, how you were feeling about that as you were getting ready to go into surgery and have this technology placed within you. And then all of a sudden you get piled up with a head cold that turned bad.
Yeah. The symptoms were affecting me at work. I was having to leave work early because I would get there and just the way my heart was functioning would go south. And I just couldn't stand and continue to shift anymore. So when he told me about the device, I was pretty freaked out because they're literally threading electrodes into your heart to shock it when it's not functioning correctly. That's pretty invasive. So for me, it was very weird to think about, okay, for the next 10 or 15 years, you're going to have this device in there. It's going to help you. It's going to probably save your life. But the prospect of going through the surgery, I was just very nervous. And of course, I had to, they set the surgery for one day, and then he's like, they called like the date, like 2 days before the surgery on a Monday, and they said, you take Plavix, don't you? And I said, yeah. And they're like, oh, well, sorry about that. We're going to have to postpone the surgery for another week. I'm like, I already took the time off work. Oh, sorry. And so I contacted my boss, and she's like, well, I've already done the schedule, which was kind of, you know, crappy on her part, seeing what I was going through. It wasn't like calling off for a head cold. And so I had to struggle calling all my coworkers, getting their phone numbers, and seeing if anybody would cover my shifts. And I got all 3 days covered except for the fourth day. And I was like, I told her, I said, well, I'll just have to call off sick that day because I've got to go in for surgery and I'm spending the night. So I just can't do it. You know, sorry about that. But, you know, I've got to look after myself. I can't worry about whether or not I'm standing up here in front of the door at Meijer. You know, that's going to be a priority over the fact of getting my heart saved. So there was a lot of stress involved in that. And because of course that was going to be 2 weeks. I was going to be off work without pay. And so there was a lot of stress involved there, plus the stress of the surgery. And I was just trying to do a lot of Qigong work, a lot of meditation, a lot of centering myself and doing body mindfulness and basically working through the emotions to trying to make myself understand that they're all empty, even though they're, of course, important. You know, they are transitory. I just tried, you know, trying to get past the hump of it, letting it just drive me absolutely nuts with, you know, stress. So just trying my best there. And then I went to go to do the surgery. And the doctor's like, oh, you know, this is, he does like, the office is like, oh, he does like 9 or 10 of these a week. Like, holy crap. They're like, oh, yeah, basically just like drive through surgery. It's real, it's ironic that they kind of put it that way because it was very invasive. So I was, you know, got to the hospital, got changed into one of those horrible gowns, which of course just really helps out the self-esteem as well. And being prepped, and they're like, yeah, we're going to have to give you 2 IVs. I'm like, you've got to be kidding me. So, of course, they pricked me in both arms for an IV to be pumping stuff in. And getting prepped, and then I didn't really have much time in the room to really take much in. I was there for an hour, maybe 45 minutes. And they were like, okay, well, come down to take you up. And I was like, oh, okay, already? Yeah, you're ready to go, man. We're ready to take you to surgery. And during my time in my room, the guy that is the spokesman for the device that they were going to put in came in to explain to me how it works, how it functions, and that I'll get this unit mailed to me to where I can press a button and it can read the device and send a message to my doctor to let him see the readout of my heart. So it's kind of really, really neat equipment to have. And they started wheeling me down. Of course, my heart began to beat a lot faster, and I really didn't know what to expect. My main concern was pain, not being able to. I wanted to be completely numbed up like I was with my last catheterization, which they gave me fentanyl. And I got there, and it was the main guy in the lab was the one that was there for my catheterization. So he's like, oh, you still want to listen to 80s music? I'm like, yep, please put it in. So they put in really great music, overhead speaker of 80s music, jamming in the background. And I said, I'm a little stressed. Can you give me something for stress? My doctor's like, hook him up, give him something. And I said, I don't want to feel anything like last time. I want to be completely numb. And he's like, we'll give you a little extra. So they had me lay there, and then they're like, okay, you've got to turn your head to the right. And I don't have a lot of flexibility in my neck anymore. And so I tried to get as comfortable as I possibly could. And then they said, we're going to put a covering over your face. And it's like, okay, that's going to be very nerve-wracking, not even being able to see what's going on. But it was to make sure that I didn't like move my beard or move over into the surgery area and to probably lower my stress levels, ironically. And so they shot me full of stuff. I started to feel really good and relaxed and numbed up. I tested by pricking myself with my nail and I couldn't feel a single thing. And then they started cutting into me. They put the towel over me so I couldn't see. I could see out a little out the back of the towel. I could see them walking around in the light, but that was about it. The surgery took about an hour to hour and a half. Man, he was just digging in my chest. I knew after this surgery that my chest was going to really hurt. Because not only did they slice open the chest, but then they basically form a pocket in the fat and muscle, and then they basically jam the device down into there and then thread it into the heart. So as he's like pushing and jamming, just trying to shove that thing into my chest, I was like, can you go a little softer? Oh no, I've almost got it. I've almost got it in there. It's like, I hope so, because you're like just tearing at my chest with that thing. And then they were done, and I had a surgery tape on it, and then a gauze patch, and then three pressure weight patches on my shoulder covering the upper chest area where the device was. And I scooted back over to the bed, and they took me up. I kind of tried to get comfortable, and I had two IVs in, so they finally unplugged one and they unplugged the other. So luckily I didn't have the feeding tube going up somewhere I had to drag around the room. My body had been through the ringer. My fear subsided a little bit, but now there was the fear of like, okay, how's this thing going to function? Am I going to feel different? What's recovery going to be like? Because I was worried about getting back to work, of course. I mean, I know I shouldn't have, but, got to pay the bills and, you want to have some semblance of normalcy. And so I waited a week and I went back to work and I worked one day. And then on the second day, I was in such bad shape. I basically had to go up and talk to the manager and I laid out everything that I had just been through the week before. And she's like, oh my God, I can't believe you came back this early. And I thought, well, I thought I would be recovered a lot sooner. I basically said, Can you give me paid days off that I have for the next couple days so I at least have a paycheck going into having a week or two off? And I took a week off. Then I filed the paperwork to take another week off. And then I came back to work after 2 weeks, and I worked a day. Everything was fine. I was a little worn out, but everything was fine. I worked a second day. It was a little harder. And then I worked a third day, and it was like, nope, you're not going to make it. And I called and I told the manager, I was like, I'm sorry, but I can't do it. I've got to say when I've got to bow out. Sorry about having to leave. And she's like, wow, didn't you just work 2 days? It's like, yep, but those days were fine and today's not. So she's like, well, do what you got to do. So I went home and I only worked 3 days this month a week. So I have an extra day off to recuperate the beginning of this week. And now I've got tomorrow off and I actually go back to work again. So I have a little bit of anxiety about what the heck's going to go on with how I'm going to feel at the door, because I'm going to call off enough that I'm going to get fired is the problem. But I can't work if I can't even stand up. So it's kind of in a, well, it's ironic because they hired a person who was severely handicapped in an electric wheelchair to be one of the door people. And I'm like, if you can hire someone who's in a wheelchair, I think you can afford to let me have a stool to sit down on to do my shift. But they don't see it that way. So it's kind of just talking to a brick wall sometimes about what you need as an employee. They don't want to have anybody rocking the boat, you know what I mean? So it's kind of like they don't deal with a lot of nuance very easily. Luckily, my boss has been pretty supportive so far. She gave me my review and she's like, oh, you're doing fine for what you were here. So that was kind of a nice, you're doing a good job still, even though you're missing so much work. And then I got home and I've been doing a lot of specific stretches in Qigong for the chest and the shoulder area and just energy building exercises to try to energize the body so it has extra energy to put to the area to heal. I'm also taking a supply of three different herbs specific just for heart health and oxygenation of the heart, and the will help the hopefully will help the infraction rate get back up to a normal level. So when they told me I have to wait a week and not take Plavix because it's a blood thinner, during that week I started getting sick my th in my throat, and I was like, this is going to turn into something terrible. So I called and got an appointment with my doctor. When I woke up, it was in my head and in my chest. And luckily, I got antibiotics and got enough in me quick enough that I was able to get over it, pretty much most of it, before I had to have the surgery on that following Monday. So I did have to deal with that before the surgery, but I wasn't going to let them know that because I didn't want them to say, oh, we got to cancel another week. To them, it's not a big deal, but it completely uproots my life big time.
So during this whole process too, you had sent me a message or two, and you had said something to the effect, you said you were afraid. And I thought that was so compelling and brave of you to say, because the situation, of course, is serious. And it's multi-layers of serious. It's serious in the physical idea of mortality, but then you've got the compounded stuff of living in the realm, like having to meet your financial stuff and, just your basic life. This is so disruptive, as you said. And for someone that has done, you're like such a great example of a Sifu where you are a community outreach person and You just live the lifestyle. You live the lifestyle. And this is one of the things why I have such immense respect for you. But let's talk about how scary this was, has been, or could, you know, moving through, looking at the disruptions, including the possible ending of your life. Where did that take you?
We all have death as a permanent companion on our journey through life. It put it in the forefront for me a very viscerally, shall we say. I thought, okay, I can die on the operating table. I can die because my heart's not functioning correctly. If it goes south even further, there can be complications of the surgery area after surgery. I could move wrong and rip it open and start bleeding everywhere and have to drive myself or call an ambulance to go to the hospital to get sewn back up again. So it played a pivotal role, and I took the time to do what in Buddhism is called the charnel ground meditation, which is a series of visualizations that you do of yourself dying and decaying and basically turning into dust, and then nothing's left afterwards except emptiness. And you try to rest within that void in which all things are possible and all things can be birthed, and to try to become one with it so that if it is your time, you know, you try to approach it with a calm mind so that karmatic winds aren't blowing you to a unfortunate rebirth. I also took the time to write out a will and mailed it to my daughter. I kept her in a loop. I let her know everything that's going on and how serious this was. And just tried to make, you know, a very, like, make plans as if you might be called away on a trip you never know. So be ready and don't have your roots down too deep, and just kind of go into it with mindfulness and try to let fear just guide you through the process and make you very sensitive to all that's going on with your body and with the environment and the people around you. Being mindful during that helps out degrade the fear a bit. But, you know, knowing my heart, this is the second heart failure I've had, and everybody in my family dies in their 50s and 60s. All of them did due to heart disease. Mom, both my aunts, my uncle, you know, that kind of stays in the forefront because ironically, I have five cousins and they all, none of them have the genetic diseases that kind of runs rampant in the families. But unfortunately, I got all the diseases as a carrier of the genetics for some reason. So they don't have these health problems. And unfortunately, I've got like all of the various types of health problems that runs in our various family lineages. So heart disease has kind of always been, you know, right there front and center. Like, you know, you better take care of your heart, which I wasn't the best adept at taking that as seriously as I possibly should, but I tried my hardest many times and fell off the wagon, got back on. But I never really had heart problems until basically about 24 years ago, and that's when they first started.
So let's look at when you're writing up your will. This is a very personal experience, and knowing that you're going to send this to your daughter and you're dealing with this whole flood of emotions. What is that like? What was that like for you? Because it's not like writing a will when you're in fine health. You were writing one almost an emergency status because you knew this situation was underway and ongoing, that there was a surgery and all this. What was that like?
Well, it makes you do a cataloging of your life and think about your relationship to Do they own you or do you own them? What's the emotions of loss? The emotions of like seeing your personality being taken apart by a bunch of different people, and they all take a piece of you with them. And that's what happens when you divvy up the items you have. And of course, I have a bunch of Asian artwork. Some of it's very expensive, and a small library. So I wanted that to go to a couple of my best friends that are interested in some of the same things I am, and would help them just gain, you know, some extra goodies in their life that they could use for whatever. And I told my daughter basically to sell everything else and just use it to cover costs. And I just basically told him, you know, just, you know, stick me in a plot somewhere, have me cremated. It's no big deal. Whatever you want to do, it's up to you. So you go through the process of thinking about that stuff and how to, you know, come face to face with it and have to deal with it and, you know, play your game of chess with death and just think about, you know, any moment I can be checkmated and that's going to be the end of it. I better have everything in the right place at the right time as best as I possibly can and not to put anything off anymore. So there's, you know, trepidation, there's fear, there's a sense of loss, there's a sense of personal deconstruction, there's a sense of losing oneself, a sense of almost like somebody comes in and says, we've got to sell all your stuff now, you know, right away. That's kind of what it has a feeling of, like, you know, I'm going to be almost auctioned off to the highest bidder kind of thinking, but you don't know who's going to buy what and who will take, you know, what. You want something that you have to, that you've took your life kind of collecting to be appreciated by somebody. Unfortunately, my daughter doesn't have the same drives or hobbies, anything really that I have, except video games and some other things we talk about. But she really wouldn't, library wouldn't be interested in her, and the Asian artwork wouldn't be interested to her. So it's kind of, that was kind of sad. That made me a little sad thinking that it wasn't going to go to her because she would appreciate it. But, you know, she's her own person, but still the emotion was there to process nonetheless.
How did your daughter take this all together as just a whole bunch of information? You've got this will, you're going through this surgery, the instability of what could possibly have been around the corner.
She was pretty stoic about the whole thing. You know, we were texting back and forth a lot. I was letting her know all the details of what's going on and then talk with her also just to make sure she, you know, knows I love her and everything like that. And, you know, you just, you might be the time when you say goodbye, you know, so it's kind of like, well, you texted everybody to say you're going in and it's been a good show in case anything goes wrong. And you just basically accept death as it comes to you. And I think, she's seen me go through some really horrible things, especially when they first started detecting heart disease. We were in hospitals all the time, D.C., Cleveland, Lorraine, just all these different hospitals. And so she's kind of had firsthand experience of seeing me suffer and barely be able to move and black out and pass out and have, like, you know, I'm having a heart attack and being in the hospital for 3 or 4 days recovering from it. So she's kind of gotten used to it as much as you possibly can, I guess you can say.
What is the general prognosis with the tech you have in you now? How, you know, this is obviously state of the art. It's all the new stuff. You know, how do they feel about this moving forward with your individual case?
They are very positive that hopefully the heart will begin to heal itself and get back its strength we're somewhat basically just at the mercy of genetics and at the mercy of the body's natural healing ability, plus herbalisms and exercise and stretching and pressure point work. I got some pressure points from one of the grandmasters, the one of the martial arts systems I've trained in. You know, he gave me some ideas about herbs to use, as well as pressure points to use for the heart, you know, pressing down on them for 3 to 4 minutes a day for each pressure point, and just, you know, doing a daily routine of it to help the heart heal. And try to have an upbeat attitude, not let stress get to you, which is easier said than done. But they think that I should be able to recover. The device will not only shock the heart when it needs to be put back into rhythm, but it's also a defibrillator, like you see they have in buildings for when someone has a heart attack and you pull it out and you shock the person on their chest. It's one of those things actually too. So if my heart actually stops, it will shock it back into operating, which I was told by someone who has one also, that it feels like you've been kicked in the chest by a mule. It was interesting wow. When I went back to work, how many people missed me at work, and they were very concerned and wanted to know what was going on. Because while I'm at work, I, for the time being, I need my arm in a sling because of the side where the surgery was gets sore standing there moving around, and everybody wanted to know what was going on. And you wouldn't believe how many men with a pacemaker or the same device that was in the store, they kind of were like, huh, well, you seem a little young for having that. I was like, well, I got heart disease runs in my family. And they're like, oh, okay, I get to understand. Yeah, I got heart disease myself, and they've got a pacemaker. And it was just interesting. I think I probably talked to a dozen men in a couple weeks period that have pacemakers or defibrillators in their chest.
Wow. That's, I mean, it's staggering to think about how widespread some of this is, and we just don't really know.
When you don't realize what's going on, and then all of a sudden you're privy to information about the population out there, it's like, wow, you know, it's something that they're doing that's normal for them, but to us it's a very invasive operation. But they're doing them, so many of them so quickly, you kind of got to wonder, do you really need to do the surgery, or are you just making sure you do the surgery? Mm-hmm. There is that little bit in the back of your mind of like, is this really needed? Is it really necessary?
Yeah.
And of course they're going to tell you, yeah, you know, of course, heck yeah, it is.
Yeah, just like they do with teeth.
Oh, no, you need all your wisdom teeth out when they don't hurt. You need them out anyways.
Right, and pre-cavity, where you actually don't have a cavity, but they fill it because it has pre-cavity condition, all that we've lived through. So I know we're getting close. I wanted to not take up a huge amount of time because I know your strength is low. But how are you feeling moving into the future, away from this now, moving down the road further? What's going on for you?
There's going to be touch and go for a while with my health, of just trying to regain my strength and regain my ability to work my normal hours at work and get back onto some type of regular schedule, but also take seriously the recovery of my health, trying to get my heart back in operating condition, and just be very, very upfront with my doctor about my concerns, and, you know, have him, if he's going to put my concerns to rest, or he can tell me something different that will ease my stress about the whole process. And just try to be very forthcoming with being proactive towards my health and everything like that. And just try to get normal again, I guess you could say. The last time it took me, gosh, took me 6 to 9 months to recuperate from the last congestive heart failure. But there was a second thing that was going on at the same time I had that. So it was a double whammy. I was in a hospital 3 weeks for that one. But yeah, and so this heart failure isn't as bad as the last one, but it still has rocked my world pretty good. The last couple of days I've had a lot of problems breathing and some chest pain. So there's stuff is still there going on with the heart disease that I have on top of all of this with the heart failure. I've got the normal problematic operations of the heart on a daily basis that I have to deal with, and it's just become second nature for me. You know, for someone seeing me clasp my heart and go down to my knees, they think I'm dying. For me, it's like, oh, just give me a second. I've got to catch my breath and I'll be ready to go. And they're kind of like, shouldn't we go to the hospital? No, they won't be able to find anything. And you just go on with your business, just living with it. Like, you know, if you lose an arm or a leg, well, you know, you just try to alter your life to work around whatever defects or weaknesses that you have.
Yeah. Are you ready to die?
Yeah.
You feel prepared?
I'm pretty, I did a lot of reflecting on that, and it's like, well, you know, I've had a pretty good run at things. So if it's time to go, you know, that's cool. Time to go to the heavenly realms and make a life there and see people I haven't seen in a long time. So, you know, it's kind of like would be a homecoming.
Yeah.
So to me, it was not something negative, but just something very much of a change in a mindset towards your mortality.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's just a shift of consciousness. But, you know, you do this work. A lot of people don't. So looking back at your life, as we were talking about earlier, what is or has been the most important things that stick out? Because you must be reviewing all the stuff in your head, at least. What has made your life interesting to you, golden to you? What do you cherish the most?
Well, my drive and desire to study religion, the occult, magic, anthropology, archaeology. You know, I had a major and two minors in my schooling, and really trying to figure out how the mind works and getting a degree in psychology for that very purpose. Also getting a degree in thanatology and psychology, the times when I had addiction and I fought through that for a couple years, getting married, getting divorced, having a daughter and all the ups and downs of child rearing, moving to multiple places, living in Alaska, living for a week down in the Carolinas, traveling four states just to train in a martial arts in Arkansas.
Yes.
And just writing all my books that I've written. And I've got so much more I'm doing. So I've got, like, I think 22 books that I've already started and have written part of them. So there's a whole list of books I want to get published before I shuffle off, if possible. So I guess it's a lot of stuff. The passing of my mom and my dad, you know, that's another big one.
There's a lot to us in the end, and we're complex. And when we are faced with these moments of really cataloging our experiences here and the love, the joy, the lessons, all of it, it's a lot. And it's important to look at this stuff. Now, I know that we had, there was a way for people to donate to you. So first and foremost, I think if people could support you by buying your many, many books, that's a wonderful way. So how can people get access to your books, first of all, to buy those? Let's start there.
Well, you can go on to, excuse me.
Yeah, we're wrapping.
You can
here.
Go on to Amazon.com and just put my name in, Alan Sisko or Reverend Sisko, Reverend Alan Sisko. You can also go to Lulu.com and look for my name on there. I've got two books I've published through that, or three books, two or three books I published through Lulu.com.
Okay, excellent. And then also, I know that for anyone that wants to help you, aside from that, there are ways. Like, so how can they PayPal you? What's the PayPal address?
It's just redlotustemple@aol.com. Above and beyond that, there is also Venmo, and it's Alan Cisco. So my name has got a picture of my cat as the avatar. So Venmo's another place. All the stuff listed there. You can find it on my Facebook page, which is just Alan Cisco, AlanCisco. You can see all my posts there if you want to follow and you want to see whatever updates that I put on there for about what I've been going through with this recovery and such. I keep everybody on there up to date and, you know, pretty open about it. So anybody can learn from it that they have the ability to, you know, see the life journey of someone and kind of get an inside scoop, I guess you could say.
So spell your last name for people again.
C-I-C-C-O.
Okay. Excellent.
Yeah.
All right, Alan, I love you, and I am always, always in your camp. You are a gift, and I hope people understand that really, truly. And you have helped people. This has been something you've done for so long. It's part of the Marshall training, and
yeah.
It shines in you. It shines bright. And so I hope the best path forward unfolds and that people can find your books, and if you see fit out there and are able to throw a little bit Alan's way in this time of need. So Alan Cisco, thank you for being here to tell us what's happened so that people in a wider audience can also know what's going on. And I appreciate everything you've ever done for the Cosmic Salon and being a good friend of mine. Thank you.
But no, thank you so much for being such a great friend and inspiration, and always, always a fun time on the Cosmic Salon. Every time I enjoy coming here every time. Thank you.
Well, we love you, and we love you in the speakeasy. So everyone, don't dream it's over. Remember, you are the dreamer. The dreamer feeds the dream. The dreamer awakens within the dream. Thank you for being here and dreaming with Alan Cisco and myself. All right. There we have it. Another show here in the Cosmic Salon. I want to thank the producers of the show. Cass, Claire Cathcart, Denise Bissell, Eggtooth, Liz Radican, Eric Peterson, Heather, Jake Vanek, Jennifer the Bruce, Kate Kukulkan, Carrie, Laura Dunn, Lynn Radius, Marcy Shapiro, Mark Betcher, Melanie Poe, Mia Bell, Neil McNaughton, Noelle Jeanette, Pamela Hodall, Rachel Wahlberg, Rod Knight, Sarah Etta, Stephen Mercer, Susan Jenkins, Susan Miller, Wise Night Owl, and Babs, our moderator extraordinaire in the green room, as well as my partner here, Miss Meowface Killa on Instagram, Meredith, who runs all of the socials out there and does the booking. Much love to you, Meredith, and thank you. As well as everyone else that comes to the Cosmic Salon and spends your time or money or energies here, I much appreciate it. We are growing in number. There is an undertow, and things are happening. Our lights are shining bright in the darkness of this current time. So thank you. As always, the dreamer loves the dream. The dreamer feeds the dream. The dreamer awakens within the dream. Thank you for dreaming here with me in the Cosmic Salon.